Welcome to Beyond the Scope, a podcast where we explore the intricacies of healthcare through conversations with the pioneers in health. What's going on, where it's heading, and how it affects us all. This is Jerry, and together with my fellow hosts, Krish and Nishanth, we hope this inspires and challenges you to join in on the conversation. So yeah, so maybe just to start off with, Kenny, maybe you could just tell us about a bit of your background and how you got started with, or how you got into healthcare and then eventually Shured here.
Sure. Well, I got my start in public health, global public health. So I'm actually an epidemiologist by training. I have an MPH in epidemiology and a PhD in global public health. And I got interested in global public health because I originally worked at a hospital called National Jewish in Denver, Colorado. And really my interest in TB sparked because there was a gentleman that was brought to the hospital when I was working there as a laboratory researcher named Andrew Speaker. And Andrew Speaker had XDR TB, and he had got on a plane in Europe, flown through Canada and crossed the border in the U.S. to get home when he found out he had XDR TB. And it was this big international uproar. Oh my gosh, he got on this plane. And, you know, it sparked my interest in the fact that, you know, diseases spread borders very quickly. And I can't even remember the date of this, but, you know, it was like 15 years ago. And it was just for me, it was like, wow, this is really fascinating. And that really sparked me to get, to go into public health. So that's kind of was my entry into healthcare. But I think it was really fortuitous for the work that I would end up undertaking.
And for the world that we live in today as well.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So for the world as well. Yeah. Very relevant given where we're at right now.
Kelly, were you working with TB before that happened? Or were you working with other infectious diseases?
No, I was actually working in a pulmonology lab and doing mouse model research on lung cancer and COPD. So very much more sort of the biological bench science. I knew I wanted to be a scientist, but I think for me, it was more about macro level healthcare trends and helping patients sort of on a higher level. Bench science wasn't what I wanted to do long term. And so, you know, I kind of pulled back from that and decided, look, I want to, you know, really work with patients on a higher level and try to affect health trends as opposed to, helping individual patients, which was not my strong suit, and working in the lab was just not for me long term.
And then so how did that sort of move into, you know, more specifically our TB and adherence and more innovative mm-hmm. ways of ensuring adherence for tuberculosis patients?
During my MPH, I started working in Dr. Richard Garfien's research group at the University of California, San Diego. So I had worked for him as a research assistant, and his lab had recently received a grant from the NIH to essentially make the burden of directly observed therapy for TB to build out a remote model for doing directly observed therapy. And so he received this grant from the NIH, and I was a research associate with him. And so I was really part of the sort of ground up team that was able to develop a mobile option for conducting in-person directly or for conducting remote directly observed therapy for right. TB patients. And I can talk a little bit about why that's important in a second, but I think, you know, the reality was that, you know, we just started sort of it as an academic exercise. Our goal was to help reduce the burden on patients and providers for conducting this very expensive form of therapy and monitoring patients in a very burdensome way. And at the time, cell phones were just starting to become smartphones were just starting to become ubiquitous. It was 2010 when we received this grant. You know, the iPhone had been out for a few years. Apps were starting to, you know, gain traction. And we said, you know, we could do this via video phone. And we called it these George Jetson phones. They were these big things you plugged into the wall and they had a video connected. And we thought, well, that's silly. Patients aren't going to be using landlines much longer. And so, you know, let's not do that. Let's build an app to do what we want to do. And so we did. So we worked with the Qualcomm Institute at the University of California And they built us just this very simple application to allow a patient to send, you know, record a video of themselves ingesting their medications and then upload it to a backend website. And then we decided to evaluate that. So we built a research study around that to, you know, put it in the field and have nurses give feedback on it, have patients give feedback on it, and then see how, you know, effective it was in, you know, supporting patients. So yeah, it was really just born out of research. Which was, you know, I think a great path. Yeah.
So was this still like roughly, you know, 2010, 2011 when you started to do research on this formally?
Yes. So 2010, 2011, we started doing our first research studies. We received some follow-on funding from a number of different groups that helped us to scale the evaluation into outside of San Diego and California, Tijuana, Mexico, into 5 counties across California. We started working with a group up in Seattle, King County, in Washington, a group in New York City, so the New York City Department of Public Health, and then also a group in the UK who, you know, had the similar plan to sort of ease the burden of in-person DOT and said, look, we don't want to reinvent the wheel, so we'll use the platform that you've all developed. And their paper was actually eventually published in The Lancet. So, you know, I think we, from the outset, we focused on building the evidence around this methodology and not immediately saying, well, let's build a company around it. It was like, well, no, let's figure out if this works, if patients are going to think that it's worthy, if providers are going to think that it's worthy. And then, you know, we built it from there once we, you know, really had some solid, robust evidence around it.
And so kind of just trying to understand the context here, this is still like in high income countries where this was kind of like born, and the research was mostly done in high income countries, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. So we originally started our research studies in the US and UK. What I think was important in this context is that, so maybe to bring it back a little bit with TB and why medication adherence is so important and why it's difficult in various regions of the world. TB is a highly infectious disease. It's also deadly. And if patients don't take their medications, it results in very high morbidity and mortality. Also treatment regimens are difficult. They range from 6 months to up to 2 years if a patient has multi-drug resistant TB. And those drugs cause a lot of side effects. They're very uncomfortable to take. There's a lot of pills. So some patients are taking 20 pills a day. So you can imagine that regimen is very burdensome on the patient, and they need a lot of support to get through treatment. Mm-hmm. And so the way that the World Health Organization has said, look, you know, we're going to recommend for TB, the only way to get a patient through treatment successfully is to, you know, really do in-depth case management and what's called directly observed therapy. And that means that a provider is watching the patient in person every single day to take their meds. So for example, in the US, a nurse is driving to that patient's home or place of work on a daily basis and watching them take their meds. So in the US, the public health system really takes on the cost and burden of sort of the travel. But when we're looking in Europe, and then really anywhere in low resource settings, the burden tends to be on the patient to conduct the DOT. So the patient is, you know, driving to the clinic on a daily basis, picking up their medications, you know, going through that process of reporting side effects. And that has to be during business hours. It has to be when they can talk to a nurse. And so it's incredibly inconvenient. It's in the middle of their workday. And patients have lives outside of their disease, right? And so, you know, the way DOT is very difficult. And so we sought out, you know, a way to change this. And I think at the time, telehealth was not overly accepted. You know, it was still kind of new. Everybody was going, well, if you watch a patient take their medications on a video, do you really know they took them? How can you be sure? You know, and so I think we felt like that was just not a concern, that patients want to get better. They need a way to do that in a very, you know, low burden way. And so we started in the US because it represented a very sort of obvious solution for the healthcare settings, right? Like the cost was roughly a third of what it costs to do in-person DOT when they conducted video dot. So also when we did it asynchronously versus sort of a live interaction, the patients could actually take their medications outside of business hours. You know, they could take them right before they went to bed and sleep through the side effects. They could take them with a meal. And they also didn't have the stigma of having a county car show up there at their house or office every day and watch them. So I think it was we started there, and then we eventually moved out into, looking to see where we could implement this in high burden disease regions, in countries where there's a lot of TB, but maybe not as much, not as many resources to roll out a program like this, maybe not as much access to connectivity or devices, and started doing research there as well.
So Kelly, from what it sounds like to me here, from a business point of view, you guys just did the right steps, start with the problem, identify the problem, validate the problem, and then you just scaled up, which is great. But I think when you were starting out, it was a research project. And a lot of research projects in the healthcare system end up being a research project, and they don't spin off into a successful company like how you guys did it. So how did you create a business case for ShoAdhere? When was the switch from going from research to a independent company?
Yeah, I think that was really key for us. So one of the main drivers for us was that, it was sitting with our technology was sitting within the university, and we were winding down our research studies. So as you may know, research grants usually last a couple of years. And so I think our longest one ended in 2015. And as those studies were ending, we didn't have money to keep the platform running internally at the university. And many of our health departments that we were working with, at that point we had, I think, about 8 health departments in the US who had signed on to conduct evaluations, and then another, the UK group. And they were saying, hey, we want to keep using this. Don't take this away from us. This has turned into a standard of care. Our patients love this. It's saving us a ton of money. We don't want to go back to conducting in-person DOT, and there's not another solution on the market. So what we did is we said, okay, well, let's figure out a way to do this. We have to get the technology out of the university because, the university was not set up to, conduct a business basically with the tech. And so we went through the technology transfer office at the university, and we licensed our prototype platform from the university. Then when we pulled it out, we were able to sort of set up a second instance of that as our SaaS-based, sort of version one, we called it, of ShoAdhere. And we formed a little company around it. The goal, I think, really at the outset was a social enterprise focused on access to the technology because we had seen such huge benefits for it, and the health departments were sort of clamoring for it. So it was really kind of a demand-based switch that we made, that our health departments wanted it, and we wanted to find a way to bring it to them in a low-cost mechanism.
And so the payers here would be the health system providers, like the hospitals, or is it the insurance companies?
Yeah, so in public health, it's typically, when you think public health, it's usually government-funded clinics. And so in our case, I would say, 100% of public health in the U.S. is sort of government-funded. Now, they can go through Medicaid or Medicare to be reimbursed for their services, and they often do. At the time, though, telehealth was not reimbursed very readily. And in fact, an asynchronous visit wasn't reimbursed at all. The health department still said, look, we're going to find room in our budgets to pay for this, because even though we can't be reimbursed for it, we can be reimbursed for the care of the patient. So they were still able to, be reimbursed for the general care they were providing for the patient. They could be reimbursed for the DOT at a much lower level, but they weren't reimbursed for the technology itself. It was saving them so much money overall that it just didn't make sense to go back, and their burden was so much lower. And one of the benefits that I think was really important is that it helped them to focus their resources much more clearly. So it went from having to spread their staff resources out to every single patient with TB. So maybe they have 150 patients on TB at once. They're having to do DOT on 150 patients every single day. That went to, you know, being able to focus their resources on the patients that really needed that extra conversation on the day, as opposed to, you know, having somebody who's just going through their meds, they're taking their pills every day and they're not having complications. They could kind of triage that list and focus their resources on patients who really needed that extra support. And so again, I think really key for them.
The primary payer here is the health system, and their yes. interest here is in TB specifically because it's such a communicable disease.
Yes.
Has the market expanded beyond communicable diseases? Are there other kind of participants who will benefit from this, or is it limited to somebody like a health department wanting to prioritize the public health?
Yeah, so I think that's another really good question. So originally we developed this for TB. And, you know, being public health researchers, that was kind of how we got our start. That was our real beachhead market. But very shortly after we began implementing this for TB, we started getting inquiries from a number of different other providers that do care for different conditions, like more behavioral health focused, HIV prevention, hepatitis C, I think is another that has been very focused on. And then, you know, when we're thinking about behavioral health support, it's really, you know, in the US, we do medication assisted treatment for substance use disorder. And patients in those clinics also have to do in-person DOT. And so what we kind of branched out to focus on diseases or conditions that really required high levels of, you know, fidelity to medications. You know, places where losing a day or a dose could result in, you know, high levels of morbidity or mortality, or cost the healthcare system, you know, a lot of money if there's relapse. So in the case of hepatitis C, those drugs are really expensive. And so it's really critical to take them, because if you miss a dose and you have to take another course, it's expensive to do that on the insurance companies. And so, you know, while public health is really sort of government funded, Medicaid, Medicare type insurance, when we've moved towards, you know, these other types of diseases, I think, you know, insurance companies have started seeing the benefits of this. And I think, you know, I think SHRD here is really on the cusp of trying to, especially with COVID, see where else we can use this and really support patients who need high fidelity to medications and help lower costs for the health system overall.
So how does, like, so it sounds like you guys were at the cusp of the telemedicine revolution, and you rode that wave, and now you're also probably riding the COVID wave. How do you guys position yourself amongst the many competitors, like say Teladoc, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think we're pretty niche, and we also have priced ourselves in terms of access. And so SHRD here has really kind of had this social mission from the outset. And, you know, when you think about Teladoc, you know, the model is they have their own clinicians that see patients, and then they have a platform to enable that to happen. You know, in our situation, it's really a provider needs a very specific type of software to conduct work that they're already doing. And in fact, it would never be sort of outsourced to a Teladoc, or, you know, they really, the health department has their own providers, and they're not going to use outside providers to conduct those types of visits. And so again, I think it's kind of a niche where we fit and we fill a gap that's desperately needed among clinics that wouldn't really have the resources to otherwise go and, you know, purchase very expensive, you know, enterprise type solutions, you know, even implementing, you know, Zoom at their clinics can, you know, purchasing a multiple license of Zoom for healthcare in their clinics is still potentially, you know, a barrier for many of these health departments that are small. They don't have a lot of resources. You know, many are still using fax and paper records. And so again, you know, while we see, you know, as technologists, we see sort of this boom happening, I think, you know, it takes, the healthcare industry moves very slowly. And having some very targeted solutions for them has really been SHRD here's niche.
In this case, the patients also are interested in making sure they adhere to the drugs. Have they been interested in the solution directly, or are you primarily looking to go with insurance?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. We have had instances in the U.S. where I have personally gotten phone calls from a patient who has started, you know, they live in a jurisdiction that doesn't have a telehealth option at their health department. And so I've personally gotten calls from patients saying, hey, you know, I did some research. I see that your solution is out there. I want to use it. How do I get my health department to use it? But the issue here is that we don't want to charge the patient for our services. You know, it doesn't, that type of model doesn't work very well, because what we really need, you know, the benefit to the healthcare department is that they're using our web application to monitor videos. They're entering some data around those videos. You know, they're really building an electronic DOT record, and they also have special, you know, things they need to insert into their EMRs. You know, that database is pretty key to the work that we do. And so it's not just about, you know, the patient recording a video and sending it to their healthcare department. It's more about, you know, the data that's collected for the health department, helping them distill that down, you know, import those reports into their medical records or print them. And so, you know, I think the reality is that the healthcare departments have to, you know, we have to host that, right? And so the cost is really in hosting that data. And so that's where the cost needs to really, you know, land, is with the clinics or with the payers themselves.
Right. And the insurance also will require a similar kind of tool as the healthcare department, so it kind of scales well. Exactly. Related question I wanted to ask was, your initial research showed that the video DOT was as effective or more effective than in-person one. So that would make sense for the healthcare department, because you're already doing in-person DOT. Mm-hmm. Did that apply to insurance companies as well? Wouldn't they be looking more in terms of general drug adherence efficacy versus comparing to a existing DOT program? Did you have to do further research analysis on those lines?
You know, again, kind of coming to from the insurance company's perspective, they're looking to keep costs low, right? And I think that they want to prevent relapse. They want to prevent, you know, complications from disease. And so obviously, you know, medication adherence is critical. I think the barrier that we run into is that for diseases or conditions where adherence is critical, but it's also only one piece that's critical for the patient, there's maybe, so for example, in diabetes, you know, adherence to a diabetes regimen, whether it be, you know, drugs or insulin, you know, insulin regimen, obviously that's critical. But also things like diet and exercise and, you know, lifestyle choices, those things are also very critical to diabetes management and, you know, things like chronic heart disease. And so what I think is important here is that we would be, you know, if our system would be rolled out for those types of conditions, you know, on a standard of care approach, what we would be doing is putting an added burden on the health system to watch these videos. Because if a patient is going to, you know, go through the process of taking a video, it's really not, you don't want to put added burden on the patient if nobody's going to be looking at that video on the back end. And to really get a healthcare provider to look at those videos, you know, that it's not really realistic from a scale standpoint. They might do it for one patient who really needs that increased support, but they're not going to do it for the broad, you know, variety of their patients. And so I think it's important to, you know, really kind of understand where our solution is applicable. And in my mind, not try to force a patient to take on an added burden or force an added burden on the healthcare system when there's other ways to support that diabetes patient. And I think we've seen huge, you know, leaps in virtual care, not just like from a video standpoint, but from, you know, support messaging, for example, or gamification, I think was mentioned in sort of the pre-questions that you sent, you know, things like that can really help, you know, have lots of touch points with the patient, check in with them, see how they're doing, but not really, you know, force them to take a video of themselves ingesting their medications. You know, it's really about support and not monitoring. And I think, you know, in conditions where, you know, sure, here's niche again, is conditions where monitoring actually is a very heavy focus, but that's, there needs to be a support mechanism wrapped around that sort of monitoring. So that's the approach that we've taken, but I think our platform can absolutely be used to conduct sort of these less burdensome virtual care models. And I think that's where we, you know, ideally go next, is to say, look, you know, you don't necessarily need to use our platform for a video, but there's all these other, you know, great things you could do to support that patient, even if they didn't send a daily video. Maybe it's a weekly video check-in, for example. So I think lots of ways to look at that question, but also important to understand, you know, what you're asking a healthcare worker to do and what you're asking a patient to do.
I just want to say that's, I love that answer. It actually sort of 80% of that answered like the question I was going to ask you. I do have a follow-up to that. And actually I had this conversation with Christina at Think about if we were to bring SureAdhere or remote adherence technology to the National Department of Health, you know, how are we going to sort of sell it? How are we going to tell them that this isn't just policing, that it's a lot more holistic? It's not just about like looking at someone taking a pill and now pushing the burden onto the healthcare system and trying to train people to watch every single video. And then they aren't watching it. And then the patients are having to send these videos in. And so there's an unnecessary burden, as you mentioned. And so I just wanted to ask you, so then would you also say that, at least for now, in terms of treatment adherence and perhaps even resistance to medication for certain diseases, that remote monitoring is still I guess like focus on more acute diseases rather than chronic diseases like HIV, which also has the risk of, you know, resistance, and maybe even hypertension, diabetes, which has the risk of complications rather, you know, if you don't take the medications properly. So do you think in terms of treatment it's still focused on acute treatment?
I think so. I mean, when we're thinking about, you know, understanding, did a patient take their drug every single day for X days, that really we're looking at acute diseases. When we're thinking about chronic, I mean, even HIV has moved more into the chronic category now that we have very effective drugs for it. The idea would be that you're trying to sort of teach a patient a lifestyle of adherence. You know, a lifestyle of wellness in sort of that initial few months of them, you know, taking a long course of treatment, such as they would in HIV or diabetes, et cetera. And so I think where our solution could help in those situations is sort of at the onset of treatment. And we've actually used, we have partners in India that have used adherence monitoring for early initiation HIV treatment. Not with video, but just via SMS. So checking in once a day to show that they've taken their HIV meds. And again, it's about building sort of this lifestyle of adherence or a habit of adherence, as opposed to sort of this monitoring approach. And I think we also are starting to move that direction in TB. And I think, you know, the TB activists that have really pushed for this, you know, I think have a really critical point, which is we don't want to look at treatment as sort of, you know, patronizing the patient, right, or policing the patient. That's not what it's about. I think DOT turned into that, unfortunately, and I think providers sort of use monitoring as sort of a, you know, a policing. I don't think they mean to. I think every provider that I work with has the patient's best interest in mind. But I think the patient feels like, hey, why do you need to watch me? Why do you need to parent me through this? I can take my medications. And I think the difference with TB is that those drugs are very toxic, you know, and they can be very difficult. And so, you know, it's hard. Patients need extra support. They need to check in with their provider. And I think, you know, the vast majority of patients I've spoken to over the years have said, you know, at the beginning, I was really angry about this. I hated that they had to watch me take my meds, even via video, right? But as soon as they got into it and started working with the nurses and providers, they thought, oh, wow, these people are really interested in how I'm doing. This is probably the most healthcare they've gotten really ever in their lives. Somebody is checking in with them every single day to say, how are you feeling? How are these meds making you feel? How are you eating? How are you sleeping? And that I think to me is really the, when I see public health nurses and you know, outreach workers, that's the inspiring piece to me, is they're able to take what is policing in the patient's mind initially to show it as support. And I think that the technology should augment those interactions and make those interactions more efficient, but it should never replace what I think that, you know, that support mechanism should look like. And I think it should allow those healthcare workers to do their jobs better and not sort of be a replacement for that, you know, support and interaction and making the patient feel like, hey, wow, this is the most somebody has cared about me, you know, really ever from a healthcare standpoint. And maybe just one more point on that. When we're looking at doing this in, you know, low resource settings, many patients have not had interactions with the healthcare system at all, or very infrequently. And in many of those cases, they also have gotten very poor care because they're, you know, sort of relegated to, you know, very poorly funded clinics in rural areas, for example, or government-run clinics that just don't have the resources to provide, you know, high-tech care. And so again, our goal is to say, look, we're not trying to just monitor you. We want to support you. We know that this treatment is really difficult. We're trying to find ways to, one, ease your burden so you don't have to come to the clinic every day, and two, check in with you on the regular so we know how you're feeling and get you through treatment. And so I think really, you know, the health departments that take that approach are very successful in getting their patients through care, and the technology is really just there to assist them to do it.
So, Kelly, you mentioned India, you mentioned, you know, rural countries, settings. So what's the expansion plans for SHURD here looking like?
Yeah, so SHURD here, well, we started in the US and almost immediately expanded into the UK. We have ongoing sort of proof of concepts with government partners and health department partners across the EU and in Singapore.
In Singapore.
Oh, nice. We're working with the National Center for Infectious Disease on a proof of concept right now. And then we formed, maybe to back up a little bit, a couple years ago, in 2017, our team had been really working on getting WHO sort of acceptance or approval of video DOT as a replacement for in-person DOT. And the way WHO makes sort of these recommendations or formal recommendations is that they really look at the evidence. They say, you know, what evidence is out there to support us giving a country a recommendation for, you know, implementing a certain technology or taking this up. And so we were able to, not just we, I would say there's a huge coalition of people that were working on video DOT. And our co-founder, Rich Garfin, he was actually on a task force to help make this happen. And so we, WHO in 2017 came out and said, you know, video DOT can now be, you know, an approved replacement for in-person DOT where appropriate. So where a patient has a phone, where the technology is available, et cetera. At the same time, they also said there's two more adherence solutions that are also building up the evidence base around them. So a solution called 99 Dots, which is basically patients making an SMS or a missed call to a healthcare provider to report their medications. And then also a wireless pill box made by a company in South Africa called Wise Pill. It's a pill box. When you open the box, it sends a signal from an SMS. From SIM card, you know, their SIM card enabled boxes, sends a signal to an adherence platform. So again, sort of a proxy for medication adherence. And so there was enough evidence around these three technologies that WHO said, you know, all of these can replace in-person DOT where appropriate. But with the caveat that, you know, we're going to continue building the evidence. And so the two companies out there, Everwell Health Solutions and Wise Pill Technologies, you know, that we're all sort of championing these different technologies, that the countries that were looking at WHO guidelines said, hey, you know, okay, great. We want to roll out all three. We see the ability to provide patients, you know, we can cover huge portions of our patient populations with these technologies, but we want them on one platform. And we don't want to have to go to SHURD here and Everwell and Wisepill and roll out three different platforms in our country. It's just incredibly inefficient, especially in nationalized healthcare systems where, you know, it's really sort of top level procurement and sort of a top down approach in terms of rolling things out. And so SHURD here formed a licensing partnership and consulting partnership with Everwell. And what we did is we licensed pieces of our technology to them, and they were able to integrate them into the Everwell Hub. which is their platform. And then, you know, Rich and I actually work very closely with Everwell to help scale VOD into low resource settings. And so the goal with our engagement with Everwell is to scale Video.dot, but also allow countries to have sort of a one platform option or a one stop shop for, you know, procuring these technologies and rolling them out at the national level. And so through that partnership, our technology is now being used in 13 countries. And by the end of this year, I think we'll be supporting roughly 35,000 patients on VOD via the Everwell Hub. So I think, you know, we've seen actually sort of, you know, really exciting scale come to these technologies via our partnership, our partnerships with donors and stakeholders at the Stop TB Partnership, at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, USAID, and others have been really key in one, you know, supporting countries to roll these technologies out, but two, I think, can really help drive the agenda and, you know, continue building the evidence base around these technologies. So countries have options for TB because, you know, TB prior to COVID was the number one killer due to infectious disease. And so I think the priority really does need to be there to help patients get their treatment.
Kelly, follow up here. I think you've given us a glimpse of what's happening now and potentially in the future, how things are going. But now with COVID in the works, how are things going to change? Have you needed to pivot or is this an opportunity? How do you look at it?
Yeah, so I think COVID has really been an opportunity for us. And I don't like saying that because I don't want to, you know, take advantage of what I,
yeah,
right, right. But I think that COVID has shown a huge opportunity to, for really everyone, every health system on earth to look at telehealth more seriously and realize that, you know, there's less burdensome ways that can actually increase access to care for patients. You know, we can now reach rural clinics as long as there's a Wi-Fi connection in this rural, you know, village somewhere, or even a cell signal, or even just a phone signal, right? You can now provide care over a device. And so I think COVID has really shown that that we can do this and that it's, you know, it's effective in many situations. And so we should be doing it, you know, more often and be less adverse to sort of, you know, losing that interaction. And there's also ways to reimburse for it and to be paid for it. And so I think that's also been, I think, really key. COVID has shown that. So in terms of, you know, what I think COVID has done to, you know, our specific landscape with VOD and other adherence technologies is that, you know, in-person DOT is really not possible right now. Patients cannot come to the clinic. They're, you know, countries are still on lockdown. And so we have to have a way to have a touch point with patients to see if they're taking their medications. And we've got to find a way to, you know, to get them their meds on a monthly basis while still checking in with them on a daily basis. And so I think that, you know, access to adherence technologies has actually grown. And in fact, in some of our work with, you know, countries in low resource settings, they're able to right now apply for emergency funding for COVID, you know, COVID related technology rollouts or, you know, COVID related TB support, right? Like how do we keep TB care going during COVID? And so the Global Fund has issued emergency funding for this specific purpose. And so we've seen countries who've called us and said, hey, you know, we're going to implement digital adherence technologies where they might have been 2 years down the road still. They've said, you know, COVID has really brought up this timeline. We're ready to now roll these things out now because we don't have a solution for patients. And so we really want to roll these things out now. So we're, you know, we're hoping to see a number of countries come online later this year with you know, COVID emergency funds. And I think in sort of more high income countries, for sure here specifically, we've seen a, sort of, again, a similar rush towards doing Video.dot. So for example, one of our partners in Europe, the country didn't specifically do DOT on patients. So they really just gave TB patients their meds and connected with them when they could. But now they've really moved towards a model of Video.dot because it enables them to not just have watch the patient take their meds, but it again enables like a check-in with them. How are you doing? Patients report how they're feeling on those videos. They're able to report, you know, it's almost like a mini, you know, check-in on a daily basis. And so COVID has sort of force them to start considering other mechanisms for touch points with their patients. And I think video is really key, and actually asynchronous video has turned out to be a desire because they don't want to have to do it during business hours as everybody is super stretched right now. So I think asynchronous video dot has been, you know, requested more often recently, you know, due to this issue. But I also think, you know, it has made the competitive landscape different. you know, I think there's, you know, many telehealth companies coming onto the market right now. And, you know, so I think it's made the landscape much more crowded. And so, you know, we'll see where things shake out. But I feel really confident that, you know, SHRD here has built a very strong reputation in public health. I think we've built a solid and robust platform. And I think that our relationships, you know, with our partners, you know, they're coming to us because they trust us. And, you know, so we'll see where things land.
Great. So this question is a little bit more of a clairvoyant question, you know, lead up to all the things that we've shared with us so far. Generally, what I've observed is founders in their realm are able to see a little more further than most people. So where do you see you know, adherence technology heading towards, you know, new ways, new tech? What do you see coming out in the future? Could you give us a glimpse?
Yeah. So, well, for our own tech, I think, and even, you know, other adherence technologies are out there, I think we're definitely going to see more automation coming from, you know, AI-enabled type technologies, more triage-focused mechanisms that allow us to not just you know, have that adherence touch point, but actually triage that very quickly via AI to the right person, you know, figure out whether that patient, for example, reported something on a video and be able to highlight that video above, you know, as a risk above others. I think so AI, I think, is
right for the insurance processing. Yeah.
Yes, I think you're right. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a company out there called AI Cure. They've been doing AI, you know, review of videos for a long time. They do it mostly in the clinical trial space. But I think, you know, we're really going to see, I think, more AI-enabled tools and more rapid triage of sort of these signals, adherence signals that are coming in to get them to patient or to get them to the provider more quickly. So I think that will be interesting to see. I also think that it's really going to change from a model of monitoring to a model of support. You know, we're already doing that in diabetes and HIV, you know, hypertension, et cetera. And I think that, you know, for TB and even substance use disorder, moving away from sort of this punitive model of monitoring, I think is going to be key in the coming years because patients, I think, know more. There's a lot more health literacy out there right now. I think health literacy in many situations is up because we have so much more access to information. Now, that's not everywhere for sure, but in many of the markets we work in, patients are much more informed and they have an opinion about the type of care that they want. And so I think it's going to really behoove us to come up with support mechanisms that are less burdensome on the patient and really provide them with, you know, care that they desire as opposed to care that they're told that they should have, right? And so I think we're really going to need to move in that direction in the coming years.
And have you seen anything to do with wearable devices or VR, AR, anything to do with adherence with these technologies?
We've seen, I guess the company was Proteus. Proteus was an ingestible sensor, but they had a wearable patch.
Yes.
So So I think, you know, that type of technology, I think, is out there. I think it's probably not likely to scale. In fact, Proteus didn't overall do very well sort of in the consumer market or in the, you know, broad healthcare market. They're much more focused on clinical trials. You know, I think from an adherence standpoint, self-monitoring adherence, absolutely. I think we're going to see lots of new apps that come out there that help patients take their, you know, their heart disease medications or their diabetes medications. I think we're already seeing some gamification come out around, you know, potentially sort of VR or AR models around, you know, gamifying healthcare. I absolutely see that happening. Now, I think from my standpoint as a scientist and as an academic, my question is how effective are sort of these new sort of sexy technologies? I think we have to, I think medication adherence is a critical field. You know, we health systems lose billions of dollars every year because patients don't take their medications. So it's critical. And I think there's a lot of space for entrepreneurs to come in and do really cool things with, you know, helping patients take their meds. But what I've seen is patients do this, they'll stay engaged with the app for, you know, a couple of weeks, a couple of months, but then their engagement drops off. And so, you know, because people get tired of using it and they're not getting enough incentive from that, sort of that game, right? You get tired of things. And so it drops off. And so it's not helping them long term. And I would wonder what the treatment outcome is associated with it. Are these, you know, types of, you know, new tools really supporting outcomes long term? And so I think we really do need to take a step back and say, okay, cool tools are great, but let's find cool tools that work. And to really do some robust academic evaluations around these tools, randomized controlled trials to understand, are they working better over the standard of care that's already there? And really understanding, like, is a doctor going to engage with that? You know, so if the patient is engaging with it and it's resulting in better outcomes and they're able to stick with it, then that sounds like a pretty fantastic tool. If the doctor has to engage with that tool as well in order for it to be fantastic, you have a lot more buy-in that has to happen from the healthcare system. So again, a lot of research is needed around that. And I think the reason that just a simple mechanism of a video observed therapy has had staying power is that we really built that foundation and evidence first. Mm. Now, it took a long time. I mean, you think about where we were. It was 2010 when we first started doing this. And we're in 2021 and the system is still starting to take this up. I mean, we still are out there explaining what VideoDot is. And so it's just a slow process and you kind of have to be on board for a long, you know, a long uptake and turnaround. But what I am really proud of is that, you know, our system, we've really taken what was sort of a research study at a university, and by way of a huge team, or not a huge team, actually a pretty small team, but you know, lots of championship over you know, a decade, we've seen it go from an academic research study to really a standard of care for TB and other diseases where adherence is really critical. And so I think the evidence base has helped drive that. And so, you know, we're pretty proud of that and would love to see other technologies take a similar path, hopefully on an expedited timeframe.
Kelly, you've shared so much. So we're going to have to end off. But, you know, I just want to say that we've spoken a lot about Shred here and the technology. But I think there's also stuff about you as a person being very persistent over, you know, 10 years, you know, how this has been, you know, it was kind of like the foundation of this was in research. And, you know, within your research is trying to understand all aspects, you know, what people think, how patients feel, how providers feel, just so that they have a, you know, a holistic treatment. And also I like the fact that you really emphasize that the technology is to support, right? And I think that's the most important thing as we go. We don't want to have a very like rudimentary healthcare system where it's always top down. It's always doctors or healthcare providers telling patients what to do and there's no conversation. So your platform also allows for that conversation. I think that's one of the principles that you're trying to put into this. So I think it's incredible. We wish you all the best for the years to come.
Thank you.
And that you can overcome the hurdles. But yeah, just before we end off though, if people do want to contact you, you know, do you have like any, your Twitter handle, Instagram, you know, something that you, I didn't actually prep you for this.
Is there a dot yes. handle as well?
So I think at Sherd here, definitely. We, you know, I have to say we're not great at being active on social media. We're a pretty small team and I'm bad at that, but I am on LinkedIn. I'll send you my LinkedIn handle, and when you tweet this out, you can tweet it with it.
Okay,
cool. Sounds good.
Yeah, definitely find us on Twitter at Sherd here. Apologies for not being overly active on social media.
Yeah, we have to try and get there.
Focus
too,
on the problem. That's what's
yeah.
important.
Yeah. I wish. I need an intern to do that for me.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us today for this episode of Beyond the Scope, and hope you enjoyed the discussion. We are working on bringing more such conversations to you and hope to build a community of people excited to improve the healthcare ecosystem around the world. And we'd love to hear from you so we can get better at this. You can find us at Beyond the Scope Cast on Instagram, Twitter, or your favorite podcast platform. The link is in the show notes. And do give us a rating if you enjoyed listening. Take care and stay healthy.